Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. We've got a special episode today, a debate about trade barriers between George Mason University economist Donald Boudreau and the head of Americans for Limited Government, Rick Manning. The event was held by the Soho Forum in New York City on November 13th, and the proposition under debate was the following. The U.S. government should unilaterally abolish all tariffs and duties on imports and all subsidies to exports, thereby making all reciprocal trade agreements with other countries unnecessary. Boudreau took the affirmative position, and Manning took the negative side. About 200 people attended the Oxford-style debate. That means that the audience votes ahead of time, saying which side it agrees with, and then again after the debate. The winner is the debater that gains more votes. Reason partners with the Soho Forum, which hosts a debate each month in New York's East Village at the Great Subculture Theater. Go to thesohoforum.org for information about upcoming debates and to see who won the free trade or the protectionist side.
Don Boudreau, you have 12 minutes to defend the resolution. The U.S. government should unilaterally abolish all tariffs and duties on imports and all subsidies to exports, thereby making all reciprocal trade agreements with other countries unnecessary. Take it away, Don.
Thanks, Gene. I'm happy to be here. The economic benefit of free trade, even unilaterally adopted free trade, is that it ensures access to the maximum possible quantity of goods and services and the maximum possible variety of goods and services. In contrast, restraints on trade artificially reduce people's access to goods and services. Restraints on trade create artificial scarcity. I ask, how can we be made richer by our government obstructing our access to goods and services, regardless of what other governments do? Goods and services that we judge by our voluntary actions, by our spending our own money, to be worthwhile. Would you be enriched if government annually destroys, say, 5% of your household goods? Let's say you own $50,000 worth of household and personal goods. You have furniture like a sofa and a desk. You have appliances like a washer and a dryer, a coffee maker. You have an automobile in your garage. You have clothing in your closet. You have pharmaceuticals in your medicine chest. Would you be enriched if each year the government hired thugs to destroy $2,500 worth of these possessions? They break into your house and destroy them. Of course not. While a few producers might benefit, say the furniture maker who sells you a sofa after the thugs destroyed your older one, clearly you and your family are made poorer by this policy that is explicitly designed to increase the amount of scarcity that you must endure. A policy of protective tariffs differs in no economically relevant ways from a policy of routinely deploying thugs to break into people's house to destroy household possessions. The only difference is superficial. A policy of protective tariffs artificially reduces the amount of goods that you and your family enjoy by reducing the amount that you initially acquire, while a policy of deploying destructive thugs reduces the amount of goods that you and your family enjoy by reducing the amounts only after you bring those goods home. Either way, you're poorer. Many people reject this comparison of destructive thuggery with protective tariffs. Surely government-orchestrated destruction differs fundamentally from trade barriers, they say. But they're wrong. Even protectionists cannot avoid admitting that trade barriers and thuggery have the same initial effect, fewer goods and services available for peaceful people to consume. Ah, replies the protectionist. See, I didn't call them protectionists. The key word here is initial. We protectionists advocate the artificial creation of greater scarcity today as a means of increasing abundance tomorrow. The artificial scarcity that we create with trade barriers creates more and better paying jobs at home, thus increasing abundance tomorrow. If you fall for this protectionist canard, understand that a policy of destructive thuggery can be justified on exactly the same grounds. The government can point to the jobs that exist only because it hired thugs to bust your sofa to pieces and to slash the tires on your car. So I urge you to ask a protectionist, what's the difference if a job in, say, the domestic furniture industry is created because a government agent prevents you from buying a chair made in China, compared to a job in the domestic furniture industry being created because a government agent destroys a chair that's already in your home? In either case, a job is created in the furniture industry and you must spend more money to buy a new chair. Aha, shouts the protectionist with a gotcha grin. Unlike the destruction of household goods, trade barriers force you to buy more domestically made goods. If all the U.S. government did was to destroy existing goods, Americans would replace many of these with imported goods and thus not support American jobs. Trade barriers ensure that domestic jobs are created. Wrong. Protectionists fail to see a fundamental feature of all trade, namely, sellers sell only because they want something in return. Foreigners sell to Americans only because they wish to buy from Americans or to invest in America. And foreigners are the same as you. If you ask yourself why you work, the answer ultimately is to earn income in order to buy goods and services, or to the extent that you save, to buy goods and services tomorrow. What do foreigners who supply Americans with imports do with the dollars that they earn? The same as you. Spend or invest them in the United States. And dollars spent and invested in the United States support jobs in the American economy no less than if they are spent and invested by Mr. Chen Li from China or Mr. Chuck Li from Virginia. When Mr. Li from China sells furniture to Americans, he earns dollars. He spends some of these dollars buying American exports. He buys, say, American-made pharmaceuticals. The dollars he does not spend, he invests in America. He, say, opens a restaurant here in Manhattan. In both cases, jobs are supported in America. And so by preventing the Chinese Mr. Li from selling furniture to Americans, not only does our government directly make us Americans as consumers poorer by obliging us to pay higher prices for furniture, our government also destroys jobs in industries that produce U.S. exports and in industries supported by foreign investment. You see, it isn't true that imports destroy jobs. I challenge you to look at the data. You'll find that as imports into the U.S. have risen over the years, both absolutely and as a percentage of GDP, there has been absolutely no effect on the number of jobs, none. International trade neither destroys nor creates jobs on net. Instead, trade shifts jobs from sectors where workers produce less efficiently to sectors where they produce more efficiently. A trade barrier that protects, say, Jones' job in the steel mill destroys Smith's job in the tire factory or the pharmaceutical lab. No one denies that trade destroys particular existing jobs, but trade also creates other particular jobs. Those jobs are destroyed by protectionism. And so if someone insists on focusing only on the particular jobs destroyed by trade in order to assert that trade destroys jobs, I can assert with equal validity that protectionism destroys particular jobs and say protectionism destroys jobs. A larger point is that all economic change destroys some particular jobs and creates others. International trade isn't unique in this front. If you choose to eat more meals at home, you destroy jobs in local restaurants. If you go on the Atkins diet, you destroy jobs in breweries and bakeries, and you create jobs on cattle ranches and on pig farms. If you quit smoking and become more health conscious, you destroy jobs in the tobacco industry and create jobs at gyms. International trade is just one of the many different avenues on which travel the forces of healthy economic competition and of positive economic change. And in a large country such as the United States, trade remains a relatively minor source of job destruction and creation. The upper estimate of the number of jobs in America that have been destroyed by U.S. trade with China since that country entered the WTO in 2001 is 4 million. That's the top estimate. Do you know how many jobs are destroyed on average each month in the United States? And I'm not talking about quits. I'm talking about jobs destroyed because the consumer demand for those jobs have fallen. The answer is 1.7 million. Each month, on average, 1.7 million jobs in the U.S. are destroyed because consumer demand for the outputs of those jobs have fallen. But also other jobs are created, which is why each month we see generally, except in recessions, a net increase in jobs. 1.7 million on average destroyed and roughly 1.8, 1.9 million jobs created. So my point here is that in any average 71-day period in the U.S., a period of just 7 weeks, there's destroyed by your economic change, it has nothing to do with, not much to do with economic, with international trade. As many jobs are destroyed in that 7 week period as it just has been destroyed by the allegedly horrible trade we've had with China over the past 16 years. But what about allegedly unfair trade practices by foreign governments? Shouldn't we retaliate when Beijing, say, subsidizes producers who compete with American producers? No. I agree that such trade practices are unfair, but they're not unfair to Americans. They're unfair to people subsidizing, they're unfair to the people of the subsidizing countries. A foreign government subsidy might well enable foreign firms to sell more to American consumers, but two important facts go unnoticed by those who call for U.S. government retaliation. First, the subsidy isn't free. That subsidy draws resources away from other sectors of that foreign economy into the subsidized sector. So unless you believe that government agents are somehow miraculous at directing the economy, foreign government subsidies make that economy less effective. It draws resources away from where the market would direct them and put them in, and puts those resources into less efficient uses. The second thing that's missed by those who call for retaliation is that those subsidies make us Americans, to the extent that we buy the subsidized exports from those countries, it makes us richer. We get these goods at artificially low prices. We're no more harmed by getting gifts from foreigners than you're harmed if you get a gift from your neighbor. Look at the data and look at history. The freer is trade, the higher is both the country's per capita income and its rate of economic growth. We can hypothesize, you can spin stories about what if this, what if that, but history knows of no country that has been held hostage to a country that practices managed trade. In all cases, from Hong Kong, a perfectly free trading nation, and Britain in the late 19th century, a perfectly free trading nation, to not quite perfectly free trading, but still largely free trading nations, such as the U.S. becoming more free trade over the post-World War II period, as nations become freer in trading, they become wealthier, the average standard of living rises. I do not understand those people who, like Mr. Manning, his organization, Americans for Limited Government, takes a lot of positions that I heartily support. I understand why, say, Bernie Sanders supports protectionism. He doesn't like the market. And so it's natural for him not to like trade. It's natural for him to trust government bureaucrats to run foreign economies well and to run our domestic economy well. I don't understand people who claim to support the market, who support protectionism. That's supporting intervention by government bureaucrats. Protectionism is government intervention. And it's government intervention always against fellow citizens. It artificially raises the price American consumers pay for household goods. It artificially raises the prices that American producers pay for raw materials and inputs. It artificially reduces capital accumulation and entrepreneurship in America. And it artificially fuels special interest politicking and rent seeking, which is what always happens when you have government involved in directing economic matters. It trusts politicians and bureaucrats with all the power to superintend the economic affairs of all Americans. Protectionism makes us less free, and it makes us less prosperous, regardless of the practice of other countries. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. Thank you, Don. Rick Manning, you have 12 minutes to take the negative on the resolution. Take it away, Rick.
Gene, I really appreciate you having me here. You know, as a non-economist, when I received the invitation to participate here, I've kind of felt like a Christian being invited into the Coliseum to meet the lions for dinner. But, however, since this debate is largely a political one and not an economic question, I'm confident that the audience will find that I have some smooth stones at my disposal to take down this Goliath. After listening to the affirmative, I want to remind you, the audience, of what this debate's about, because he didn't talk about the actual affirmative. The affirmative is the U.S. government should unilaterally abolish all tariffs and duties on imports and all subsidies to exports, thereby making all reciprocal trade agreements with other countries unnecessary. This resolution rises or falls on three words: unilaterally, should, and unnecessary. Because ultimately, the affirmative demands that the U.S. should, in the real world, take unilateral actions which, in practical application, will cause reciprocal trade agreements to become unnecessary. So as we begin, we'll examine these three areas, even if he doesn't want to. Let's start with the terms unilateral and reciprocal. Unilateral action is the opposite of seeking reciprocal trade agreements as a precondition to lowering tariffs and lifting subsidies. But reciprocity is not merely a negotiating stance. As we shall see, it has been a basic building block for sustainable free trade and other agreements in modern history. In order to understand the need for reciprocity, one need only look at Professor Boudreau's own book, Globalization, a $61 requirement for his Econ 309 students at George Mason University. Professor Boudreau writes unequivocally on page 123, quote, "By far the most important modern institution for promoting freer international trade is the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade, GATT," end quote. Why is that? Well, as Professor Boudreau explains in his book, GATT was based on reciprocity, and he outlines all of its advantages. Quote, under GATT, countries mutually agree to lower their tariffs and to grant most favored trading status to each member of the GATT agreement. From each government's perspective, the immediate gain, the gain that is most politically beneficial, is that each government can assure its citizens that in exchange for lowering tariffs at home, that government has extracted promises from foreign governments to lower their tariffs. Because each government's tariff reductions are bound together in a single agreement, no government has to worry that it has will lower tariffs without other governments lowering their tariffs simultaneously in accordance with the terms of the agreement. End quote, his words. As the book continues, Professor Boudreau must agree that lower tariffs have only encouraged more global trade, arguing the result has been freer trade. It was GATT which propelled U.S. tariff rates on imports to fall from an average of 30% at the end of World War II to about 5% today, and drove down tariff rates all around the world between developed nations. GATT facilitated the tariff reductions that the affirmative world so desires, proving that the tariff reduction could not be done unilaterally, but only through reciprocal trade agreements, which the affirmative declines. Professor Boudreau ends the argument succinctly on page 124, writing, quote, no other such sustained decrease in tariff rates is found in U.S. history, end quote. He also adds, most informed observers credit GATT for this success. In short, it is none other than Professor Boudreau who persuasively makes the case in his book that the mutual reciprocal trade agreements in GATT are the only reason for the sustained reduction of tariff rates worldwide we see today. If the goal is free trade, if the goal is to continue reducing tariffs and other non-tariff trade barriers around the world in a sustainable manner, you must vote against the affirmative because you need reciprocal trade agreements to get there. In contrast, I expect something will be made today about Singapore's long-held unilateral near 0% tariff. For a number of reasons, this island nation's experience negates all three of the affirmative's burdens. Unilateral being more desirable than reciprocal. The real world should test, and the reciprocal agreements being unnecessary test. It's instructive that as Singapore entered GATT with their near zero tariff rate in 1973, their finance minister, Hon Sui Sen, argued vociferously for developed countries like the U.S. to lower their tariffs, noting that Singapore had already unilaterally lowered theirs. Han also urged special and deferential treatment for developing economies, whereby developed countries lower their tariffs first in order to help the lesser developed economies grow. But since Singapore's tariffs were already low, Han demanded no such non-reciprocal protection for Singapore. From Singapore's perspective, then, it was seeking reciprocal trade tariff reductions from the developed economies, and their entering GATT was a reciprocal trade agreement. To disprove the affirmative, one only needs find a single reciprocal trade agreement, I've already mentioned one, being necessary in a post-unilateral tariff reduction environment. Here with Singapore, we have several to look at. 30 years later, Singapore has succeeded in getting reciprocal trade deals, permanently eliminating all tariffs with the United States and Australia, and many other reciprocal trade deals with other countries. Coupled with a sustained dramatic decline in tariffs globally under reciprocity achieved in GATT, it would be foolish to move away from the only proven model for success, which is reciprocity. Singapore also negates the real-world should problem for the affirmative by providing a real-world example of a nation that created the framework to succeed in global trade through key domestic policies, which besides reciprocity in trade from developed economies are the true reason it competes well with its trade partners. In 1965, Singapore became independent from Malaysia and put temporary import quotas in place for a small number of products for the next 4 years. During that period, their single-party government, ended labor strikes by eliminating labor unions, aggressively built industrial infrastructure, educated its people for industrial technical jobs, reformed fiscal and monetary policy, and only then eliminated the import quotas entirely. The affirmative makes no such preparation for the U.S. economy for what would be a dangerous unilateral action should the affirmative succeed. Currently, the U.S. has the highest corporate tax rate in the developed world, an onerous regulatory regime designed to export environmental risk and restrict the flow of capital, a free market system that does not engage in top-down industrial policy, an education system that emphasizes liberal arts rather than technical education, a robust two-party system of government that slows legislative action to a crawl, which is a good thing, and a constitution that has tariffs embedded into it, not to mention politically potent labor unions. Unlike Singapore, the affirmative, since it doesn't mention it, would have politicians make the unilateral tariff cut to zero without at least significantly lowering corporate income tax as well as rolling back large portions of the administrative regulatory state, all guaranteeing a massive political backlash and failing the should test. At this point, I'd like to augment the should-slash-reality argument to the export subsidy statement in the affirmative. For the past 70 or so years, conservatives and libertarians have argued, and I was one of them, for ending agricultural subsidies unilaterally. They've failed. 70 years of failure. The reason is, if you look at a map, it is a red sea of ink in terms of the electoral map from the Appalachians to the Tehachapi Mountains in California. It is Republican country is farm country. And Republicans, your free traders, aren't going to vote to end subsidies because if they do, they will have the same political fate that Tim Huell's camp had when he voted to end agriculture subsidies in Kansas and became former Representative Tim Huell's camp shortly thereafter. Again, the affirmative has no real-world solutions because the fact is the politics are for gradual decrease of tariffs, gradual decrease of subsidies, reciprocal arrangements that make sense and cause a gradualism that gets us to where we want to go. That's the critical piece on the should. Finally, the affirmative concludes their statement, thereby making all reciprocal trade agreements with other countries unnecessary. As you recall, the negative has already shown that Singapore as a nation that unilaterally ended tariffs proves the negative by virtue of their subsequent aggressive pursuit of reciprocal free trade agreements. The fact is that reciprocal free trade agreements are not just or even primarily about tariffs or subsidies. They're about the conditions of trade, including but not limited to labor conditions, intellectual and physical property rights protections, dispute resolution, regulatory environments, customs rules, social goods, and human trafficking, among many others. Because Professor Boudreau makes no accommodation for non-economic reasons to maintain reciprocal trade deals, the affirmative position can only be that by lowering tariffs to zero, trade deals that protect against the predatory taking of intellectual property become unnecessary. Similarly, anti-human trafficking provisions and trade deals become unnecessary in the affirmative's world. The affirmative is wrong. They are dead wrong. In fact, one of the most significant trade deals in history involved human trafficking. After Great Britain eliminated the slave trade in 1807, it then pushed France and Spain to join them in the anti-slave trade treaties of 1814 and 17. These major sea powers jointly agreed to end the slave trade and use their respective nations to force the agreement. Here's the truth. It was that agreement that Abraham Lincoln signed in 1862 that put the nail in the coffin of the Confederacy because their hopes of having an agreement with Great Britain to keep them economically solvent went down the toilet because there was a moral imperative, not an economic imperative. It's a Great Britain's advantage to have an economic agreement with the South. It was in their advantage to have an agreement with the South because of increasing their imperial empire. They chose the moral commitment, and that's why you cannot just judge trade agreements based upon an economic model, because that's not the real world. It's unassailable that modern bilateral and multilateral reciprocal trade agreements have many elements beyond tariffs, making them necessary, even in a unilateral zero tariff and subsidy environment. Because at the end of the day, the U.S. will want to export goods and commodities. Do that, you'll need in all likelihood, a trade deal with the countries you are exporting to. Overall, the affirmative fails all three of its tests. One, Professor Boudreau asserts in his book that it was reciprocity that has been the vital component to sustaining and expanding free trade, not unilateral action. Two, the real world should test Boudreau imposed upon himself fails miserably. Just ask my friend, former Representative Tim Huell's camp. And three, trade agreements with other countries will remain necessary regardless of tariff rates and subsidies, because tariffs and subsidies are but a small part of modern-day reciprocal trade agreements. As such, you must vote for the affirmative, or for the negative. Got it backwards.
Don Bourgeois, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Take it away, Don.
First, let me clear the room of the red herrings. Intellectual property issues, slave issues, any non-trade or moral or ethical issues can be dealt with independently of tariffs designed to restrict a people's access to foreign goods and services. The vast majority of trade restraints are justified and, in fact, are imposed not to protect intellectual property. They are imposed to protect domestic producers in the home economy. I have never denied, I said it in my book, I don't deny it. Of course it's true that in the post-World War II era, the reciprocal trading agreements have indeed lowered tariffs. But that's because we live in a world in which governments are intent on protecting the home producers in their jurisdictions. And it so happens that because people think exports are a wonderful thing and they're the purpose of trade, when countries get to trade with one another, one country does agree to reduce its introduce its import tariffs as an alleged concession to another country to allow that second country to sell goods in that first country. The argument is not that what I understand the argument here is it's not what has been the most effective way of reducing tariffs over the past 80 years. Of course, history makes that clear. It has been the reciprocal trading arrangements that we've had under GATT and later WTO. My proposition is that even better would be for each country, including the United States, to unilaterally abolish tariffs. We do not need to wait for other countries to abolish their tariffs before we abolish our tariffs. At least among economists, a very famous point attributed to the British economist Joan Robinson, and I think it's exactly true. Joan Robinson said the notion that we should lower our tariffs only on the condition that a foreign government lowers its tariffs first is akin to saying we should stop throwing boulders into our harbors only if the other country stops throwing boulders into its harbors. GATT and the WTO have made world trade freer. It has been a success story. An even better policy, however, would be to reduce trade barriers completely, eliminate them completely. And the United States does not have to wait for China, for Japan, or any other country to do so. In the same way that New York doesn't have any trade barriers against any states. We don't need other countries to stop hurting themselves in order for us to stop hurting ourselves. Rick is right that there are a lot of, I'm sure we would agree on most of them, a lot of awful bad policies in the United States. Taxes are too high, regulatory burdens are too heavy. I agree with that. But I don't see how that problem is solved by then saying, okay, we're going to put this other tax on instead. We're going to tax our imports as well. That's just a tax. That's just another government intervention. If these other government interventions make our economy so problematic and make us so unproductive or less productive than we otherwise would be, what is solved by putting on another tariff, another tax? That's what a tariff is. It's just a tax. I don't see any reason why the interventions that we all in this room, most of us in this room, regard as detrimental to an economy suddenly become beneficial to an economy when they're put on imports. So one quick final thing before we go. I don't know if you know, but about 66%, about two-thirds of imports into the United States today are raw materials and inputs into American production. And so to the extent that we have tariffs on those imports, it's two-thirds of our imports, not consumer goods, raw materials and imports, and intermediate inputs. To the extent that we tariff and restrict those imports, we raise the cost further of American producers. That doesn't make us more productive. That makes us less productive. Thank you.
Rick Manning, 5 minutes of rebuttal from you. Thank you.
Again, I'm going to read what the affirmative is supposed to be defending. the U.S. government should unilaterally abolish all tariffs and duties on imports and all subsidies to exports, thereby making all reciprocal trade agreements with other countries unnecessary. It's really difficult to have a discussion when we're talking about two different things, but this is the affirmative. This is what we're here to talk about. You know, I'm going to give you an example, and it's going to drive Professor Boudreau nuts, but it's a good example. There's been, for many, 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 many years, there's been an attempt, and I supported it, to get rid of sugar subsidies. You know what we still have? Sugar subsidies. Because when you run at full board, straight ahead, into a buzzsaw, you always end up getting chopped to bits. Okay? That's the strategy. Let's run into the buzzsaw again this year and see if we can get, I can chop to bits this year. It happens every year. So I had a crazy kind of concept, and it was, why don't we support something called Zero for Zero? And what it does is it relies on reciprocity. Congress, under Zero for Zero, would eliminate sugar subsidies contingent upon the president going to the WTO and eliminating, getting India, Brazil, and others to bring their subsidies down to sufficiently so the president would certify it, at which point the sugar subsidies would go away. Now, it seems like a pretty obvious thing since we know, we all agree that reciprocity has worked. Yet, it's somehow using reciprocity as a means to get rid of agriculture subsidies doesn't seem to fit the bill of let's put our face into a ceiling fan and see how much we like it every single year. You know, politically, we have to deal with the real world, and that's why I brought up the red state stuff. The real world is you don't get to just say, gee, we're going to eliminate, unilaterally do stuff. Because when you do, as Don wrote in his book, again, you have what happens is the pain is very narrowly focused and is extreme, and the benefits are spread throughout the whole economy. So people only get minimal benefit that they don't actually bring any, that they don't see as being related to that. But the people who got their piece taken away, when it's not done through a systemic way, through a reciprocal agreement, those people are very mad. And that's why the net result of Don's proposal, of his affirmative, would be the Republican Party in Congress would get wiped out. Now, some of you might think that's a good idea, and I'm not far from you. But the alternative is not a libertarian. The alternative is Bernie Sanders and worse. And so if you go with the affirmative, you have to agree that that the political risk is worth the downstream payoff. Here's the challenge with the downstream payoff. We don't know what it is. We don't know what it is. What we do know is that what we have been doing has limited and lowered tariffs since 1945 from 30% to 5%. We're on a pathway to eliminating tariffs altogether, unless we go crazy and do something unilaterally and cause there to be a political backlash that ends for a generation the opportunity to end it being a tariff-free environment. That's why I said this is an economic argument. This is a political argument. That's why I took this debate. I'm a political guy. Okay, I'm about winning, and I'm tired of losing for 70 years. Anybody with if you've got a job and you're getting paid anyway and you've got a tenured professor, you can talk about this stuff all you want. My job's to win, and this is how we're going to win. So I would encourage you to negate the affirmative, and let's use the tools that have worked to get ourselves back on track and create an environment where we have American interests protected, yes, but we're doing it in a way that opens markets so they're even freer and more robust.
Thank you. Thank you, Rick. Now, in this part of the debate, each side gets to ask the other two questions. We will alternate. Don, first, a question from you that you might want to put to Rick.
I can put this in a term of a question. I wasn't aware that this was a political debate. I thought I was making an economic argument. I understand that tariffs have been lowered again by reciprocity, but Why can't we have an intellectual discussion that explores not just how to form today's winning political coalition, which I agree is important, but that's not what I'm here for. I'm here to make a case for the proper and best trade policy. It's happened in the past. We've had Britain that had freer trade. I want to make a case for free trade. I'm not here to form a political coalition that's going to win. I'm here to educate people about trade. I'm here to persuade people about trade. Why is that an illegitimate thing to do? Why should I be concerned about the politics of the matter?
Don, Rick?
Because the affirmative says should in it and not ought to. The word should means it's a policy that ought to be, that the government needs to take, that the affirmative is saying needs to happen now. It is an action word. It is not a wishful word. We're not sitting here in Galt's Gulch, okay? We're not sitting in Galt's Gulch. We have to just come to that realization. We're sitting in America. We're sitting surrounded by people who want us dead. And that's a real world consideration. And when I deal with real world considerations on Capitol Hill, when I deal with real world considerations, I don't take lightly when somebody throws something out academically that would be politically and economically disastrous. And that's why we should talk about the political end, because should is in the affirmative. And that's in that you have to defend the affirmative, Don.
Okay, Rick, you have a question for Don. Rick?
Yeah, Don, do you still believe that reciprocal trade deals will be unnecessary given the important non-tariff elements to these deals?
Yeah.
Please defend. please defend that.
All unilateral trade means is a government says we will no longer interfere with our citizens' decisions on how they spend their income. We will no longer discriminate against goods and services made abroad compared to goods and services made at home. Period. End of story. That's all we need to do.
Don, do you have another question for Rick?
I think you slipped in your last comment there. You seem to suggest that let's assume for the moment. I know it's academic, and I am an academic, right?
I'm not.
Yeah, I know.
I take that as being a good thing to not be one.
I didn't say otherwise. Let's.
We'll have to watch it on the character assassination, guys.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Let's say that politically we could do what Britain did in the mid-19th century and, in fact, go to unilateral free trade. Do you believe that would be economically disastrous? You seem to just said so.
Yeah, because I think reciprocity is the right way to do it.
You
asked the question. Now I get to answer it. Reciprocity is, as you pointed out, has been the key to success, not unilateral. In fact, you know what the last unilateral law that was passed in Congress to deal with trade? Smoot-Hawley. So you got Smoot-Hawley as your last unilateral thing that was done. And after that, we got the Reciprocal Trade Act, which then set the stage for unwinding Smoot-Hawley and 70 years of lowering trade tariffs. So if you want to engage in unilateral action, the unintended consequences can be enormously bad. And that's why I think that we want to go with a reciprocal report.
Rick, do you have your second and last question for Don?
Sure. Given that you're so fond of the consumer price being low, no matter how the goods got there, do you support slave produced goods being sold in the United States?
Come on, no.
No. Well, then you support restrictions.
No, I don't. No. What, by the way, what slave goods are being sold in the United States?
Palm oil from Malaysia. There's a book that's about this thick that the Department of Labor puts out every single year that lists slave trade. By the way, when you eat a candy bar, the cocoa that comes from the candy bar from the Ivory Coast is produced by slave labor. So just be aware that yes, there is slave labor, and when you eat your candy bar, just know you're eating it.
I would be happy to keep out goods that we know are made under slave labor. That's a very, very tiny.
Tell your wife.
Say again?
Well, I'm just saying, if I told my wife that she couldn't have chocolate, it'd be tough.
Oh, no. Well, no.
Okay, no slave labor. Okay, Don said
I actually have just one of the curses of being an academic. I have a research assistant working on this very issue now, looking at the extent of slave labor in the world, and the findings are preliminary. And the student is from China. He speaks Chinese. That's a good advantage. And what he is discovering is that the claims of slave labor abroad are vastly overblown. Much of what's called slave labor in the first world, such as the U.S., is labor that's paid wages that are a lot lower than we're paid, naturally, because these are countries that are a lot poorer. Workers who work in conditions that are worse than the conditions under which our workers work. It's easy to label something slave labor, but in fact, the world has very, very little, if any, of the kind of chattel slavery that people think of when you hear the term slave labor bandied about.
I'll take the U.S. Department of Labor's opinion over his research assistants.
Okay. We are going to have questions from those who are doing live streaming. Think about your questions from the audience. You may want to line up. Before that happens, I want to use moderator's prerogative to ask a couple of questions. Rick, do you believe, given the fact that chocolate bars have slave labor embodied in them, that chocolate bars should be completely banned by the federal government?
No, I do believe, though. Let me tell you, I'll answer it because I was the public affairs head of public affairs, chief of staff, public affairs, Department of Labor in the Bush administration, George W. Bush. And I was responsible for ILAB, which oversees child and slave labor around the world. And it doesn't oversee it, it reports on it. And although sometimes we wonder, 10 years ago, in the book, the Ivory Coast was listed because of the cocoa trade. The manufacturers, the candy companies, came together and formed a coalition that was supposed to be dealing with it. This past year, I was fortunate enough to be in the Labor Department transition team for President Trump. I met with those same people I used to work with 10 years ago. And I asked them, I looked it up. I said, well, what's happened in the last 10 years? And the answer was nothing. So should we be willing to say at our customs, when something comes in from customs that we know has been produced with slave labor, that we're going to do something about it? I think we have a moral imperative to do that. We ended when the Civil War ended, slavery was ended, and America made a choice. We can't go back to 1865.
Oh, but you're against banning chocolate bars, though, despite that. Do I understand you correctly?
My wife's against banning chocolate bars.
But I didn't ask your wife. I'm asking you. Are you against banning chocolate bars?
I think we ought to create a 5-year plan for them to get into compliance, and then we should say no more.
Okay, you do whatever your wife tells you, and I respect that. Don.
She's watching. I have to be careful.
Don, you're against banning chocolate bars from imports?
Look, if there's hard evidence that there are slaves used to make chocolate bars, I'm willing to make an exception in that case. I doubt that you would actually find that.
Okay.
So.
All right. Fair enough. Rick, my question to you is, you said that the wording "should unilaterally abolish all tariffs and duties" is clearly a political imperative in your view, and therefore you reject it. You said that it should read "ought to." If indeed the wording, hypothetically, if the wording read "it ought to unilaterally abolish all tariffs and duties on imports and all subsidies to exports," ought to, would you then be in favor of the resolution?
No, because of two reasons. Number one, the affirmative also states that it should be done unilaterally, not with reciprocity, which I think is a recipe for disaster. Secondly, since it assumes that thereby on it says that there is that we would have no more need for trade agreements, that's patently false, and that they would be unnecessary. So that's why I set up three standards, one being unilateral, one being should, and one being unnecessary, and it still would fail on the other two standards.
I see. Any comment about Rick's response, Don? Do you want to?
I don't understand why you would need a trade agreement if the United States simply said we are going to abolish all tariffs and import restrictions. Period.
Countries want to have trade agreements so they can want to export your stuff to them.
Let them
have rules.
Let them have agreements as much as they want.
Yeah. Okay. And now I think we have questions from live streaming. Jim Epstein is in the audience, and he's coming to the stage to give us the questions on live stream. Jim, do you want to read? And we
sure.
are related.
Okay, so we'll have two. This is two questions from the audience at home, which were posted in the comments. One is from Ellen Sandals. This is for Don. How could removing all taxes and regulations in the USA work in your scenario when countries we trade with continue to impose tariffs and restrictions on us?
Well, we'd make ourselves richer. We would not restrict our economic activity as much as other countries restrict their economic activity. That goes on now. I don't see why we should say we're going to keep slashing our own tires, we're going to keep slashing our own face, we're going to keep cutting off our own nose because other countries are doing the same thing. And we won't stop doing it until they do it. The world would be a better place if everybody got rid of taxes. Or reduce them to reasonable levels and reduce regulations to reasonable levels. We do not have to wait, though, for other countries to do the same thing in order for us to do it and make ourselves better.
A question for Rick now, Jim. Okay, go ahead, Jim.
This is actually, the second question is for both of you. It's from Steve McLean. With respect to the UK's exit from the European Union, a segment of Leave proponents argue that Britain should opt for no trade deal with the EU in preference of global bilateral trade deals. He'd be interested in the debate participants' responses.
Did you understand the question, Rick? Yeah, okay. Rick, take it away. Answer the question.
Well, I think that each country has to make their own decisions regarding how they want to behave in the world. If it were me, if I were part of the British government, I would look first across the pond at the United States to be the first trade partner and get as good a great deal with the United States. And then I'd look across the channel at Europe and get a deal with Europe. Because ultimately, they're an island nation. Trading is what they are. And so it'd be absurd for them to try to be just an island without any trade because they would be their economy would collapse. So yeah, they have to do trade deals. They think they should do one with the U.S. first and then the EU, but they can walk and chew gum and do both at the same time.
Thank you, Rick. Don, do you have a response?
Comment. Yeah, I don't see why Britain couldn't just say we're returning to the regime we had in the mid-19th century. No tariffs. We don't need trade deals with anyone. We just do not restrict imports into our countries, period. It's easy and it makes the country richer.
Thank you. All right. First question from the audience. Please phrase your question as a question. And so take it away, the gentleman who's in front of the mic there.
Yes. Thank you, both of you, for a spirited debate. The question is related to monetary policy. So there's many ways to influence international trade. Sticking a tariff or a duty that's congressionally passed is one way. Another way is through monetary policy. I'd like to hear both of the invitees discuss what would be, would you agree with the standard argument that a weaker domestic currency favors exports, a stronger domestic currency favors importers, and if you had to choose, what would be your ideal monetary policy?
All right, thanks for the question. Do you want to comment, John?
Yeah, this is often claimed that when a country devalues its currency, that somehow makes that country richer. I think that's nonsense. It might make exports from that country temporarily less costly to foreigners, but when you devalue your currency, what that means is you're increasing the supply of your currency relative to that of other countries. And so inflation winds up running through the system, and so the price level adjusts. Over the long run, it is impossible for a country to improve its export market by keeping its currency too low, because keeping its currency too low means inflation. Much of what is called in the modern world today, much of what is alleged to be currency devaluation or currency undervaluation is in fact no such thing. China was accused of that a number of years ago, when in fact China was really just pegging the yuan to the value of the dollar. It wasn't pernicious in my view at all. It was quite a sensible and prudent move on China's part.
Thank you, Don. Do you want to comment, Mark?
Rich, sure. Sorry. Yeah, I'd love to talk about currency manipulation and how it's is destroying America. But what we have is the Fed no longer controls our monetary policy. Our monetary policy is controlled by those who buy our treasury bonds, who buy our debt, and the people who buy our debt, at least $1 trillion worth, are the Chinese. And so you've got a and what they do is when they want to lower, make our dollar stronger, they buy more debt, and as a result, and when they want to float it, they buy less. I'm going to use a well-known pop index. It's the Big Mac Index. China has over the past since they started doing it, a Big Mac in the United States costs 45% more than the same Big Mac in China. China, in fact, has a greater disparity as a relatively developed economy than places like Pakistan. So, yeah, currency manipulation is occurring, and currency manipulation is occurring by people who want to engage in predatory prices, predatory attacks on our country. Our dollar is artificially stronger than it should be. We are exporting our inflation, but eventually running $700 billion worth of deficits every year is going to come back and it's going to bite us. And when those customers no longer want to buy the dollar, but they want to dump it.
Yeah, I should mention that the Big Mac measure was originated by The Economist. It is kind of interesting. I would imagine it's cheaper Chinese labor that makes the Big Mac cheaper in China. But you're saying slave labor. But the Big Mac is a lot cheaper there, and I'm not surprised. Next question.
The TRIPS agreement is part of GATT that protects intellectual property. To use an example within the pharmaceutical industry, what it implies is that countries around the world, except for the United States, have price controls on pharmaceuticals. The United States generally does not. In some cases does, but generally does not. It prohibits reimportation, but allows these other countries to keep their price controls. So if we were to unilaterally lift those that reimportation, which represents restriction, then the countries could keep their price controls. They would still mandate that pharmaceutical companies had to sell at whatever their price level was. And then they would, of course, export to the United States. So the question is, how could innovation be preserved if there were simply a flood of product at the Thailand rate, which is something like 99% discount to what a product is sold for in the United States? They always at the threat of they'll just simply break the patent and start manufacturing it on their own. And so the question is, how can pharmaceutical innovation be preserved? Why would a pharmaceutical company ever create a new product ever again if they could not sell it at what is required to recoup their investment in the innovation?
You want to take that question, Don?
Yeah, look, I'm not an expert in intellectual property. I'm not even sure I agree with intellectual property, but that's not up for debate here. And I am willing to concede that to the extent that we have intellectual property protections, agreements between countries to maintain those protections might be appropriate. But look, let's look at the core of the issue here. The arguments against free trade have very little to do with intellectual property. They have very little to do with slavery. Have very little to do with product quality. They're all about jobs. They're all about the alleged effect of foreign imports on domestic wages. They're all about the fear tactics stirred up about the trade deficit. They're not about intellectual property. They're about protecting American producers from foreign competition, period. And that's pretty much all of Trump's rhetoric. That's pretty much all of Bernie Sanders' rhetoric. It's something, actually, when Trump and Bernie Sanders pretty much agree completely on trade issues, right? And so that's what I want to focus on. My argument is that all these subsidiary issues aside, how to handle intellectual property disputes, how to handle confirmed cases where we have actual foreigners confirmed to be slaves, I agree that can be set aside and that can be handled separately. But the overall case for unilateral free trade is pretty strong. The U.S. government does not prevent you as a U.S. citizen from spending your money as you choose, regardless of whether you choose to buy a domestically made product or a competing product made abroad, period.
Rick.
Sure, I'll answer the intellectual property conundrum. The free trade argument is predicated on a basic assumption that we all have the same underlying values, that we all have the same value, that property is treated the same private ownership of property is treated the same in the people where we're trading it and where we're our partners as it is in America. That's not true. China does not have the same view of property as the United States. China, right now, we have technology transfer requirements being put on U.S. companies if they want to enter the Chinese markets. I would tell them not to do it. But that's what they're doing in China, is they're grabbing technology and grabbing intellectual property. Protecting intellectual property is fundamental to freedom. Because if we don't control the product of our own minds, what's the rest of this about? I mean, what's the rest of this about? So Professor Boudreau is willing to throw that by the wayside because he doesn't believe we need reciprocal trade agreements to protect property. He doesn't believe we need a WTO.
I didn't say that.
You said we could do without them. We'll figure it out some other way. So here's what you've got. You've got intellectual property is at the core of freedom. Without it, if you don't control the product of your own mind, you don't control anything. And through reciprocal trade agreements, it's the only way we can use the economic might of the United States to enforce protection of intellectual property from our companies where it's being stolen by people overseas. We all know what's happening. We read about it in the newspaper all the time. And that's why you have to negate this proposition.
Don, make a comment, then Rick, make a comment. Did you want to make a correction? Don, briefly, go ahead.
Yeah, first of all, I did concede that there may be cause and room for separate agreements to deal with intellectual property protections. But I have a deeper point. Right? In a world of complete free trade, which is the world that I would like to see, or just unilateral U.S. free trade, if not complete world free trade, it's up to each company to choose whether or not to sell its products in foreign countries. If Canada is allowing... if Canada is keeping the price of some U.S. pharmaceuticals sold there artificially low, it's up to Merck and other U.S. pharmaceuticals to choose to deal in that country or not. If they choose to continue to sell there, that's their business. They know the consequences. If not, it's not up to the government to restrict our freedom in order to protect their profits.
And just to talk on the pharmaceutical specifically and the question that was asked, if a country like Thailand or India is stealing the intellectual property, producing the core product at pennies on the dollar, and then flooding our markets because we don't have any protections on it, flooding our markets with that product, driving Merck out of business because they spent billions of dollars to develop that property, and your policy would allow it to be stolen and sold to the United States, the consumer, so they can save a few pennies on the product, then you will have no innovation in this country, and you will destroy the foundational element that is the American greatness, which is that we build stuff. We create stuff. That's what we do. And when you eliminate intellectual property, when you degrade it down to a level of being just another thing, you are denying the very essence of what America is, and I reject that wholeheartedly.
I didn't realize we were debating intellectual property here.
Well, it's part of the free trade agreements.
But it can be done independently of free trade. It can be done without a trade element to it.
How?
I confess, I haven't thought through the details of how that would be done, but I don't see why. Look, Britain had unilateral free trade from the mid-19th century until the 20th century. I don't think Britain suffered because of any robbery of its intellectual property. Britain, that was a period of high growth.
So you believe that 1850s is the same as is 2017 in terms of the movement of property, the movement of people, the movement of ideas? You know, the internet's intervened between then?
Yes, I'm aware that this is not the 19th century, but I don't see any essential difference. I don't see why what worked in the 19th century in terms of the principles of freedom will not work today.
Next question.
Would you guys support economic sanctions against apartheid South Africa?
Support economic sanctions against apartheid South Africa was the question. Don, you want to respond?
That's a good question. You know, if economic sanctions and embargoes do in fact harm other countries, then it's curious that we use the same policies to make ourselves rich. I mean, this is what Trump wants, to basically use economic sanctions against American consumers, right? and put embargoes on foreign goods coming into America, because he and his fans argue that will make us rich. Look, I don't. It's a hypothetical. I'd have to see. I don't have a good answer to that.
I do.
Okay. Good answer from you.
I'll just tell you a little story. In 1978, I was a junior at the University of Southern California, and I had politics of Sub-Saharan Africa being taught by a person who fought for the ANC, which was really kind of fun. And I had an A in the class until I answered that question. And the answer was no. And here's why. It seemed to me at the time, and I think the logic still remains, that at the time, we were opening up the economic doors to the Soviet Union. We were opening up the economic doors to China. And it said, my logic was this. If we're going to open up economic doors to those who have nuclear weapons aimed at us, then we shouldn't shut economic doors to people, to countries that on a geopolitical level support us. And so my answer at the time was no, and because I'm a man who tries to be consistent throughout his life, I retain that position.
Thank you. Next question.
My question is for Mr. Boudreau, and it's about jobs, actually. So first, philosophically speaking, your argument seems to be that trade restrictions sort of subsidize less than optimally efficient production, in that if a steel worker should be laid off for competing Chinese steel, they can then go and do a more productive job, economically speaking. But that doesn't take into account at all the productive capacity of the individual person. Not everybody has equal potential to be productive in different roles. You know, some people might not just be suited for the higher end, more sophisticated jobs. And then from a real world example, when you look at places like Detroit and the Rust Belt that have lost tremendous exporting and manufacturing jobs, and in the wake, people haven't gained new higher skill jobs. In fact, poverty has skyrocketed, drug use has skyrocketed, and communities have deteriorated. And you might attribute that to a variety of real world factors, but the fact remains that it's not upward mobility in the job market doesn't seem to be as easy as the philosophical step you seem to make it.
2 points. Number one, it's the stagnation of the American middle class is much talked about. It's actually mythical. If you look at the data and you adjust the data correctly, and people have done this, including myself, you see that there is, in fact, no stagnation of the American middle class. Middle class America today is wealthier than it has ever been, no matter how you measure it. Right? Now, of course, it's the second point. There are some people who lose jobs, and it's because of trade, and that is difficult for them. The trouble, though, with restricting international trade on that account is that then, if that's your concern, restricting international trade doesn't go far enough. So take the steel worker that you just mentioned. Suppose I'm an American. Suppose I invent a new plastic that's a really good substitute for steel. That new plastic puts the steel worker out of a job. Do you think the government should be in the business of preventing me from inventing new plastics? Mr. Manning doesn't think so, because that's a new innovation, intellectual property. Should Americans be prevented from buying my new plastic because buying my new plastic might put that steel worker out of a job? Again, every month in the United States today, on average, about 1.7 million jobs are destroyed. Each month. Again, I'm not talking about quits. And again, the upper estimate of the number of jobs that we've lost from trade with China, which has become a large trading partner, famously, over the past 16 years, is 4 million jobs. The fact is, the number of jobs that get destroyed in the economy on a daily basis is huge, and only a small fraction of those have anything to do with international trade. And so if you're going to protect people's if you're going to protect people from losing their jobs because you don't like economic change, then you got to do far more than stop international trade. You have to stop all economic activity. You have to freeze the economy where we have it now, and that would be a calamity.
Rick?
9.5 million people who ages 16 to 64 are not in the labor force today, who were in the labor force when China got PNTR. Okay, if you take the same labor participation rate for those that age group, that's what we would have in if we had that same labor participation rate. We're seeing a hollowing out of America. We're seeing people giving up hope. That's why Trump won, because people looked around and said, the government has been for me. I need a government who's going to be on my side and not on the Chinese side. Professor Boudreau comes up with a 4 million number. I can't validate it or not. I can say this, that every single day, the Chinese government wakes up and says, how do we win economically from the United States? And they're doing everything they can to do that. And the United States government needs to start thinking about the American people first and foremost as well.
Rick, you're right about the 9.5 million. And just to put a fine point on your insight, the 9.5 million not in the labor force. And then you said, then we started trading with China. So you attribute the 9.5 million dropouts to China trade?
Well, yeah, because here's what we know is true. In the year 2000, we had a 4% GDP. We haven't had a 4% GDP since then. In the last 10 years, we haven't been above 3% GDP. In fact, in the last 10 years, this is hard to imagine. We've had less GDP growth in the last 10 years than at any time in recorded history, including the Great Depression. That's just a fact.
And you attribute that fact to China trade.
I attribute it directly to China trade. The 2000 is the launch point for the decline in the manufacturing sector. It's the launch point for a variety of different factors. But the one thing we know is that we have found ourselves since 2000 in a world of hurt economically in the United States. And I will not accept the new normal of lower expectations. I believe we can do better, and we should.
I agree with that, by the way, Rick. So I want to weigh in that way. Don, you wanted to show me how to do dialectic.
Can I ask a third question to Mr. Manning? Hey, here's a quiz for you. At what point in U.S. history was U.S. manufacturing output at its peak, adjusted for inflation?
I'll let you tell me. You're the economics professor.
Today.
We only have 6.7%. Our manufacturing has been cut in half. The manufacturing sector doesn't have a percentage of the economy. As a percentage of the economy, that is true.
No. As a percentage of the economy. Right. No.
And we have 9.5 million people who, if the labor participation rate had been the same as it was in 2000, would be in the workforce. Now they're not. That's bad. They're not paying taxes. They're sitting there. They're on various public assistance programs, and it is a huge problem in this country. Unless we fix it,
and it's due to China trade.
I think it's the one. It's a seminal event that happened in 2000.
So, it's due to China trade.
Nothing to do with Obama's policies. Nothing to do with George Bush's increase in the role of government.
It's all China. Well, it is a seminal event that did happen in 2000. We also saw various other nations see their percentage of growth go down during that same time frame. But our bottom line is, whether you can attribute a small percentage of it to China or a large percentage of it to China, but you cannot deny the fact that we have exported our manufacturing sector overseas.
No, we're manufacturing more now than ever. And in fact, here's another question. When did the United States become chiefly a service sector, if you divide it into services, manufacturing, and agriculture? The year is 1911. And if you look at the trend of output in these sectors over time, services keep going up. As people get richer, they want more services. We don't want more and more food and more things. We want more and more experiences. As countries get wealthier, they consume more services. We're consuming more healthcare. We're consuming more hospitality and leisure. We're consuming more education, more of this. Manufacturing output in the United States is at its all-time peak. Manufacturing employment peaked in 1979. That's because innovation, which I applaud, innovation has dramatically reduced the need for workers in the manufacturing sector. It's not China. People have estimated, there have been many studies that have estimated the effect of China on trade with China on innovation, and none of them find that China is a major cause. Take Mr. Manning's 9.5 million. So I use 4 million. Let's go with 9.5 million, basically doubling it. So it takes roughly 5 months. 5 months of regular job churn to destroy the number of jobs the number of jobs each month is about 1.7 million that are destroyed. So that's roughly 5 or 6 months. We've been trading with China since well before 2000, but they did enter in 2000 the WTO in 2001, so we can use that as a mark date. So it's no matter how you look at the date, it's impossible to blame China for the numbers that you
well,
pull up.
You know, it's great.
Well, go ahead.
Rarely have I heard a more specious argument.
Okay.
What's specious about
well,
it?
I'm about to tell you.
Rick, explain.
I'm about
Rick,
to tell you.
Rick, explain the speciousness. Let's do it. We're running out.
It's really interesting what the churn rate is. When you're the one who's getting churned, it's really not very fun. And when you have 9.5 million Americans being churned and your churn rate, that is a disaster for the country. We have seen that disaster taking place. We're seeing parts of it from the epidemic relating to heroin. We're seeing it manifest itself in so many different ways. If we don't get people, jobs, and opportunity, our country will fail.
In other words, Professor Boudreaux spoken like a tenured professor. So it looks like we don't have any further time for questions. I'm sorry, we run out of time. Thank you to the debaters, and thank you to the questions. These guys are going to stick around over wine, and so you can buttonhole them. That's what we do at the Soho Forum. We have probably better discussions over wine at the bar later on, but we now have to conclude the debate. Don Boudreaux, you're going to get 5 minutes. Take the podium for your final rebuttal.
We see at the end here the real concern. Rick got very emotional about people losing jobs. I can get very emotional about people losing jobs, too. By the way, it's an ad hominem argument to criticize my argument because I'm a tenured professor. I started favoring free trade when I was 18, long before I was tenured, just by the way. But if you want to judge an argument by the nature of the person who delivers it, then discount my argument, because indeed I'm a tenured professor. I didn't make the rules. I would get rid of tenure. I think it's a terrible system. But in order to be a college professor in the United States today, you have to have tenure if you want to stick at the job. Anyway, the argument here at the end was that losing jobs is bad. Trade with China causes some people to lose jobs. 9.5 million is the estimate we hear, which is roughly the number of jobs that are destroyed in about 5 months. Because that's so horrible, we should stop or we should restrict trade with China. Notice, nothing to do with intellectual property, nothing to do with slavery. It's just people are losing jobs. Well, again, people lose jobs anytime there's economic change. People lost jobs when the polio vaccine was invented. Think of all those poor people who lost jobs who made wheelchairs and crutches and iron lung machines. People lose jobs when the IT sector emerged, highly innovative. People in secretarial pools, people making typewriters, they too lost jobs. As agriculture became far more mechanized starting in the 19th century, lots of people lost jobs in the agricultural sector. As manufacturing is becoming more, as innovation is replacing human labor with machines, people are losing jobs in the manufacturing. The number of jobs in the manufacturing sector declines. This is the nature of economic growth. This is called creative destruction, and it is creative. Yes, people lose jobs. There are jobs destroyed. But if you are going to base economic policy on the wish, on the desire to prevent people from losing jobs because some foreigner sells you something, then again, you can't stop there. You have to stop consumers from changing the way they spend their money for any reason. Why should we feel worse for the worker who loses a job to a Chinese import than we feel for a worker who loses a job because Steve Jobs built a machine that now has an app that makes that job redundant? Both people lose jobs. They both suffer. They're both part of this job churn. There's nothing unique about international trade in reducing jobs. The problem is people like to demonize foreigners. It's easier to demonize foreigners. It's difficult to demonize fellow consumers. So that's all I have to say.
Okay, thank you, John. Rick, 5 minutes for a conclusion by the negative. Take it away, Rick.
Thank you. Since you guys are going to be voting, let me remind you, and you know, I'm in politics, okay? I got to remind you what you're voting about.
The U.S. government should unilaterally abolish all tariffs and duties on imports and all subsidies to exports, thereby making all reciprocal trade agreements with other countries unnecessary. Once again, if the resolution failed on its the unilateral level, and you believe reciprocity is the right idea, then you need to vote to negate the proposition. Two, if you don't believe it fits a real-world description, which Professor Boudreau kind of admitted, then you have to negate the proposition. And three, if you believe that the trade agreements become unnecessary, then or do not become unnecessary, and other things matter, like intellectual property that are incorporated in them, that we get because of our economic might to force other countries to accept intellectual property, then you have to negate. I'm going to close by allowing Professor Boudreau to close for me from his book. Pages 135, 36. You get a lot of rocks and harbors in this, so I apologize. Political reality being what it is, governments very seldom practice unilateral free trade. Perversely, a government will remove rocks from its harbors only when it can be sure that other governments will remove rocks from theirs. And if other governments toss more rocks into their harbors, each government temptation is to toss more rocks into its own. But after the catastrophic orgy of choking harbors with rocks between the wars, government officials realized that they had to find some means of mutually agreeing to clear their harbors, that is, to lower tariffs and open trade. GATT and now WTO, the World Bank, and the IMF are the principal monuments to this admirable realization. GATT especially is responsible for the extraordinary post-World War II reduction in harbor-clogging tariff rates. Now get this. For free trade purists, GATT and WTO are often annoyingly modest and slow in moving the world towards freer trade. The results, though, cannot be seriously disputed. Trade today is much more free than it was just 50 years ago, and there is no sign today of any major retreat on this front. Without GATT and WTO, this progress is highly unlikely to have occurred. Okay. This is the end of his book. This is how this is a book that he assigns to his students. He makes them pay $61 to get it. I had to pay it, so you know I'm a little miffed too. It was written in 2008. Love an update, so they can't use the old books. But it makes the case. I choose to go with Professor Boudreau, who teaches his students one thing, rather than Don Boudreau, who tells you something else. You must vote to negate.
Thank you, Rick. All right, that concludes the debate.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.